Everybody knows the deal is rotten. Old Black Joe still picking cotton for your ribbons and bows. Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost.
Welcome to the Lifeboat Hour, July 6, 2014. 2 days after U.S. Independence Day, and I hope you're having a great holiday weekend and that you all had a chance to feel, I mean really feel, your non-independence. You know, when we feel our non-independence, it helps us realize how important it is to declare our interdependence with other members of our species and the more than human world. Independence is highly overrated and is pretty much over for most Americans, but the more abrupt climate change and the collapse of industrial civilization intensify, the more necessary interdependence becomes. We need each other now more than ever. So this week we had the opportunity to see another nail driven into the coffin of democracy with the Hobby Lobby Supreme Court decision, once again blatantly declaring that corporations are people. And as one sign I saw read, "I believe that corporations are people when the state of Texas executes one." Funny, but not funny. Always sarcastic and spot on, Andy Borowitz said in the report, his weekly report in the New Yorker on June 30th, that when women get in the way of the people, they must be silenced because nothing is more important in a society ruled by the plutocracy than the people. And of course, in a plutocracy, the people always means the corporation. Well, tonight we're going to spend a lot of time talking about corporations, particularly those that have to do with our food. And the focus of this show is what you're not being told about your food. But before I introduce our guest, I want to remind you that next Sunday night, July 13, Guy McPherson is going to be here with me, and we're going to talk about our new book, which we completed this week, entitled Extinction Dialogues, How to Live with Death in Mind. You do not want to miss this show, so please tell everyone about it. And also remember that all of our shows are archived at PRN-FM. Click on Shows and scroll down to the Lifeboat Hour. So without any further delay, my guest tonight is Michael Brownlee, a friend and a neighbor here in Boulder, Colorado. Michael is catalyst and co-founder of Local Food Shift Group, formerly known as Transition Colorado, and Transition Colorado was the first officially recognized transition initiative in North America. The mission of Local Food Shift is to build community resilience and self-resilience through localizing the food supply. Michael is the architect behind the Local Food Shift campaign to localize regional food systems beginning on the Front Range of Colorado, and you can visit the website at localfoodshift.com. Michael is also the publisher of Thinking Like a Food Shed, a regional magazine, and he's currently writing a book, The Local Food Shift, How Humanity Will Feed Itself in Uncertain Times. And this book is designed to ignite, inspire, guide, and empower those individuals who are awakening to harsh realities and are beginning to face the daunting challenge of localizing our food supply, forging a new and regenerative way for humanity to feed itself. Welcome to the Lifeboat Hour, Michael.
Thanks, Carolyn. It's great to be with you on the show tonight.
Well, first of all, and we have a lot to talk about, but I want to start with this question. What do you think is the single most important social challenge of our time, and why?
Well, as we head into increasingly uncertain and chaotic times, as we certainly are, I think that the biggest challenge that we're all going to have to come to grips with, and rather quickly, really, is how humanity will feed itself. Are farmers these days, caught up in a globalized, industrialized food system, are told that their job is to feed the world? But we know that this is pure propaganda, a radical distortion of reality promoted by the very forces that control much of the world's food supply. So this is going to take a couple of minutes here, but I want to put forward what I think is going on.
Please take your time.
So since World War II, an unholy alliance of transnational corporations has taken almost complete control of the way humanity feeds itself, creating really a ruthless and unprecedented dependency for this most basic of human requirements for life. But this juggernaut has been, at the same time, steadily delivering ever poorer quality food to our tables and simultaneously wreaking havoc on our planet, devastating our natural environment, depleting fossil fuels and fresh water reserves, undermining our national economies, eviscerating our communities even, and destroying human health, decreasing human life expectancy, and severing our relationship with the sacred. And now, this unholy alliance is rapidly destroying the very conditions that are conducive to and support life, to the point that this global food system is an overwhelming contributor to the sixth mass extinction of species on the planet. It's really, you could say, the food system equivalent of mountaintop removal coal mining. And it turns out that the architects of this industrial food system have so resolutely placed corporate power and profits far above the well-being of life on this planet that the inevitable result is an unfolding food catastrophe of global scale. So I think it's an obvious, if largely unspoken, reality that our global industrialized food system is profoundly unsustainable. But less obvious is the reality that it is also becoming dangerously unstable. The global industrial food system is teetering on the brink of collapse just at the moment that it pretends to be ramping up to be able to feed a world of some 9 or 10 billion people by the middle of this century. In fact, this global industrial food system has itself become the greatest threat to humanity being able to feed itself. So this system is already beginning to fail us, although it seems like that's only evident to a very few brave individuals who care enough to do the research and ask the hard questions. I think that's something that you're very accustomed to, Carolyn.
Yes, indeed.
But for those who do, it's clear that how we answer this challenge could well determine the future of humanity and even the future of life on this planet. So for all these reasons, we say that localizing our food supply is the most important and most urgent social cause on our planet today.
Well, you know, some people might be listening who don't quite understand this alliance. And so I'd like you to explain, maybe give some examples of this alliance between big food, big ag, and big pharma. Can you talk about that a bit?
I can, although I confess it makes me a little bit nervous to do so publicly. But if you were the leader of a major foreign power, and you wanted to take over control over the majority of the human population, what you do, I think, is find a way to control the food supply. Now, whether or not this ever was the original intention, this is essentially what has happened. So we could think of human industrialized civilization today, especially our cities, as a huge CAFO, a confined animal feeding operation, and really not much nicer than the massive feedlots that we subject our cattle to, or the factory farms that house and process our pigs and our chickens and our lambs and our fish. And we're not much better off than those poor suffering creatures in our factory farms. We're not raised on the open range with access to the foods that are natural to us where we live. No, instead, we're pumped full of antibiotics and hormones and fed an artificial diet of highly processed food-like items laced with toxic chemicals and drugs that are all designed to fatten us up for the market of the industrial healthcare system. We're not raised to be free-range or cage-free or grass-fed or pasture-raised. Almost everything about our lives and our diet is artificial, controlled by these giant transnational corporations. And what's amazing about all this is that we're almost completely unconscious of it. We've mostly passively accepted our plight. We've gone unconscious about our food supply and what it is doing to us. And meanwhile, as I mentioned, this system is destroying human health, not to mention the environment. We know now that life expectancy in this country is plummeting, mostly because of our diet. This system creates enormous profits and wealth for big food, big ag, and big pharma. They have made us almost completely dependent on them. And as Mark Bittman recently said in his New York Times column, they're like a parasite that's killing its host.
Wonderful. You know, you actually did answer the question without specifically answering the question. Gave us a great analogy of ourselves as being factory farm animals. Well, you know, you have said in several places that the Green Revolution, the so-called Green Revolution, was not a revolution at all, but a coup that sent us down a dreadful path, resulting in the loss of food sovereignty. And I really want to hear more about that. Please take plenty of time to explain this.
Well, you're kind of putting me on the spot here, but that's okay. The Green Revolution, which has been celebrated for decades as a great advance in human society, was really a strategy put together by transnational agrochemical corporations, really the unholy alliance that I talked about earlier, to create an ever-growing market for themselves, making us as humans dependent on industrial methods of agriculture and food production that depended on fossil fuels and chemicals and later genetic modification of our food. And it's no accident, I think, that the Green Revolution was largely responsible for the human population explosion that has so tipped the balance on this planet, creating billions of dependent, colonized consumers. Right? Vandana Shiva, of all people, can speak about this with much greater clarity than I can. But, and I encourage people to listen to Vandana Shiva because I think she is the most articulate about the Green Revolution, revolution. But perhaps it's worth saying now that real revolutions come from the bottom up, starting at the grassroots level, responding to the real needs of the people. But the Green Revolution was a coup, I say, in that it came from the top down, from the halls of industry and academia. It was supported by the heavy hand of government and the international banking industry. And as a result of the Green Revolution, which industrialized our food supply, over the years, we have almost completely lost our capacity to meet our essential food needs locally. We've lost our food sovereignty and our food security. And there's an important lesson in all of this. To the extent that we are dependent on distant sources and foreign powers for our essential needs, to precisely that same extent, we have lost our freedom. And in this context, you could say that the U.S. is one of the least free nations on the planet. And we seem to be working very, very hard to make sure that people in other nations have no more food freedom or sovereignty than we do. And I think it's also essential for us to understand that the global industrial food system has become the largest and most destructive industry in the world. It burns about 23% of global oil and gas supplies, and it contributes as much as 49% of total greenhouse gas emissions. And it's been fouling our natural environment, destroying our topsoils, depleting our freshwater reserves, weakening our bodies and minds, decreasing human life expectancy, as I said, undermining our local economies, and severing our relationship with the land and with all that is sacred in life. So the Green Revolution has had really devastating consequences on our planet.
Well, one of the things you've said is that part of the Green Revolution is the brainwashing of ourselves to think of ourselves as consumers. Can you say more about that?
Oh, boy, here's where I really get into trouble. So since World War II, we know now that hundreds of billions of dollars have been spent on getting us to consume, to buy endlessly. And the purpose of all of that is to feed corporate profits and to boost GDP without any concern for the consequences. So this has created a massive marketing and propaganda machine that's been so effective that we now automatically think of ourselves as consumers, as if this was our very identity. And culturally, you could say that it really is our identity. We've become completely passive and dependent on others for our essential needs. And in this, we've become almost like infants, unable to care for ourselves. I think that the psychological and the existential impact of this cultural shift is not discussed very often in our society today. But we could say that we have essentially been colonized by the unholy alliance of Big Ag, Big Food, and Big Pharma. To a very great degree that we are almost totally unconscious of, they control or deeply influence what we think, what and how we eat, what we want, and even how we live. And with their powerful marketing and propaganda campaign, they have assisted us in becoming mostly unconscious about where our food comes from, how it impacts the quality and viability of life on this planet. And, of course, this is all part of a growing disconnection from nature, from our humanity, from each other, and from spirit. So we say, please don't let anyone ever refer to you as a consumer. at some point, we have to learn how to decolonize our minds and our bodies and begin to take responsibility for our lives. We all need to learn to become producers and contributors. And while it's not too late for us as individuals to do all of this, it is questionable whether we can do this as a species. I don't know that we can do this as a species, but I know that we must try, because what's at stake is the future of life on this planet and the long-term future of humanity as a species.
Well, you know, this just segues right into my next question, because, you know, we're looking at the depth and the perspective here of the seriousness of this issue. So one of the things you talk about is the need for a widespread revolution in the way humanity feeds itself. So let's talk about what that would look like.
Well, I think what is needed is a massive global revolutionary movement to localize the global food supply to the greatest extent possible, starting right in our own communities, in our own regional food sheds. So it would look like us taking back our food sovereignty from that unholy alliance of big food, big ag, big pharma corporations who control it now, and rebuild our food security through localizing our food supply, producing the majority of our food needs as locally as possible, and feeding our local population first. And if we're going to feed our own populations, our local populations, to any significant degree, and if we're going to empower people in other nations to feed themselves sustainably, then what we're going to have to do is to convert a significant amount of our current commodity crop production and export agriculture to sustainably growing food for local consumption. And yes, this is a profound reversal of a paradigm that is deeply rooted in this nation, rooted in an economy of extraction and consumption with no regard for the cost to the ecosystem or the negative impacts on human health. This is the very agricultural paradigm that our federal government supports through the USDA and through the Farm Bill. In this paradigm, they do not want us to localize our food supply, for that runs completely counter to what they're trying to accomplish.
Well, I have much, much more that I want to ask you, and I'm sure there are going to be some callers later on who want to ask you some questions or make some comments. But right now we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to the Lifeboat Hour. I'm your host, Carolyn Baker, and we're talking tonight with Michael Brownlee, co-founder of Boulder, Colorado's Local Food Shift, and we're discussing the topic of what you're not being told about your food. We're going to be taking callers in a few minutes, and I really hope you call us with your questions and comments at 888-874-4888. And Michael, what is the best way that people can get in touch with you?
First of all, through our website, localfoodshift.com, and people can email me directly at michael@localfoodshift.com.
Very good, Michael. Thank you. And now, for my next question, you have written, and this is a quote, and I love what you say here. You say that the global food situation is far worse than we've apprehended. We've naively overridden our inner knowing to the point that we've instead accepted the claims of marketers and propagandists. There is no way to avoid the reality that converging global crises are rapidly becoming converging global calamities. We're in for a very rough ride on this planet, and there is likely no way to avoid catastrophic population reduction in the next few or several decades. There is likely no way to negotiate a soft landing. So that's a direct quote from you, and I'd like you to say more about this. And also, I just want to point out that you and I live in Boulder, Colorado, which was the home of the late Albert Bartlett, who was famous or infamous for his work on population die-off. Can you connect the dots for us between Bartlett's work and what you're forecasting?
Well, I'll try a little bit. First of all, let me back up and say that when we were first getting started in our organization several years ago, I thought it would be a good idea to research the diet and food production of Native Americans in the Front Range. But I quickly learned that the Native Americans did not even live in this area. They didn't think that this was a good place to live or grow food. They followed the buffalo through the Colorado Front Range, but that was about all. And now we have more than 4.5 million people living in the Colorado Front Range, projected to grow to more than 7 million people in the next few decades. And so we wonder, how in the world can we feed them? And most people think, well, we'll just import the food that we need, what we can't grow here. However, almost everywhere has, in this country, has exactly the same kind of situation. The reality is that there are just too many people for the carrying capacity of this planet. And as you know, of course, many have suggested that this planet can sustainably support no more than about a billion people,
right.
Maybe at best.
Right.
And so Al Bartlett, who unfortunately died last year after a very long and productive and inspiring life, he once chided me after I finished my very first big public talk in Boulder. He chided me that I needed to address population in every presentation that I made. Well, so sort of honoring Al Bartlett, I think it's safe to say now that we'll see a dramatic and likely catastrophic reduction in human population over the next few decades. Near-term, near-human extinction is certainly a reasonable possibility once we look at especially what's happening with global warming, because global warming will, more than anything else, drive us to the brink. And you might remember last November there was a report that was leaked from the UN International Panel on Climate Change, which the IPCC, we now know, is actually a very conservative body. And that report leaked in November, which, by the way, seems to have gotten lost since then, indicated that global warming by itself will reduce global food production capacity by 2% per decade in the coming years. That's a total reduction of about 17% by the end of the century, they said. And this is happening at a time when growing population pressure will cause demand for food to soar by 14% per decade. So these two trends will cross at some point in the fairly near future. But as you know very well, these projections do not take into account most of the positive feedbacks that Guy McPherson has brought to our attention.
Right.
And when you factor those in, there is very good reason to expect that global food production capacity will fall by some 20 to 30% within the next 20 to 30 years. That's a disaster. In fact, scientists of the Arctic Methane Emergency Group project a potential global increase of 6 degrees Celsius within the next 10 years. That's nearly 11 degrees Fahrenheit. And as Guy points out, at a 4 degrees Celsius increase, agriculture as we know it is just no longer possible. And in Boulder, at the National Center for Atmospheric Research, Jeffrey Kyle has been looking at global temperatures the last time that CO2 levels were as high as they are expected to be by the end of this century. So he's looking at the potential future based upon the ancient past. And from this, he concludes that we could see a 16 degrees Celsius increase by the end of this century. That's more than 28 degrees Fahrenheit. So these are examples of how growing global crises, particularly around food, could quickly become global catastrophes.
So in the light of all of that, you say something that I find absolutely remarkable. In the light of this dire picture that you have just given us, you say we may have already failed in terms of metrics. What we are attempting may turn out to be utterly impossible, but such is the realm of the evolutionary catalyst. I recall Winston Churchill's lesson, leadership is the ability to go from failure to failure without losing enthusiasm. So it is for us. We may completely fail 1,000 times before we ever experience or catalyze a systemic success, and yet we know that this is precisely how evolution works, relentlessly seeking to emerge through countless transitional vehicles. We ourselves are such transitional vehicles, and we must be willing to be used for this purpose. We serve something greater than what can be measured or even visible in this lifetime. Unquote. So, first of all, what is an evolutionary catalyst, and what is the something greater we serve?
Oh, boy. I realize that in writing things like that these days, in an attempt to be completely candid and honest, that I am sticking my neck out, and these words could come back to haunt me. So let me first just say something about metrics. Okay, here in Colorado, of the $12 billion worth of food that all of us in Colorado consume every year, less than 2% of that food is actually produced in this state. And this is an agricultural state. And unfortunately, that ratio holds true just about everywhere in the U.S. The unholy alliance that we talked about controls about 98% of our food supply in this country. And it appears that they want to control all 100%. So these are really daunting numbers. And localizing our food supply to any significant degree appears to some as a nearly impossible task. When we started our organization 9 years ago, well, shortly afterwards in 2007, we set a goal of 25% food localization within a decade. And, of course, that turns out to have been wildly optimistic. But here's the thing. We are learning that there are people who are emerging in communities all over the country who feel compellingly drawn to this issue and other issues as well, even though they might not understand why or what it looks like or exactly what they have to contribute. And these are people that we think of as evolutionary catalysts. We say, for evolutionary catalysts, there is a future that longs to be born in us and through us, a calling, if you will, a future that began perhaps as far back as within the initial flaring forth some 14 billion years ago, a future that has been steadily unfolding and accelerating right through to us today. Now, it's possible that all that we're doing may fail. It's possible that humanity may become extinct, or that we may completely relinquish our freedom in the name of security. Or even, it's possible that we will manage to destroy all possibilities for life on this planet. But we are learning that the forces of evolution are unstoppable, even though they may take billions of years to unfold and hit dead ends and make many detours along the way. So we could say that evolutionary catalysts today are the front line of human evolution. There's something like special forces, if you will, who have been parachuted in behind enemy lines with a seemingly impossible assignment. And our first task, once we've gotten untangled from our parachute, if we've survived the jump, is to find the rest of our team, remember what our assignment was, and get to work together. So that's essentially what it means to be an evolutionary catalyst.
Well, I really thank you for explaining that, and I admire you for all of these answers. You know, you've prefaced a lot of them with saying, well, I'm really sticking my neck out here, or, you know, I don't know, this is going to get me in trouble. But, you know, trouble is what this show is about, and, you know, certainly what my life is about is radical mischief. You know, we certainly stick together on that one. And in a few moments, we're going to be taking callers. In fact, you can call any time, and we really welcome your questions and comments. The number is 888-874-4888 with a question or a comment from Michael. And, Michael, I wanted to ask you next. You've said that we will not need to change the global industrial food system, but we will need to replace it. If we do not succeed, we will witness starvation as no longer being a third world phenomenon. Would you explain that, please?
I'll try. So,
okay.
I think that we just don't have the time or the resources to go up against the global industrial food system, the unholy alliance, to try and change it. And in reality, I don't think we need to, because that system, as I said earlier, is profoundly unsustainable and increasingly unstable. It will likely collapse at some point under its own weight. So what we most need to do right now is to create a parallel or new alternative system that is new and somewhat under the radar, at least at first. Localizing our food supply is a very radical and, you could say, even subversive effort that is growing from the ground up. But if we fail to do this in time, as the industrial food system unravels, the global food crisis that I've been talking about, driven largely by climate change, will sweep up whole nations in its path. And starvation will be widespread, even in this country. It doesn't need to come to that, but it easily could. And this sense of the urgency of the issue that so few people seem to understand right now is really what drives our work in attempting to localize our food supply to the greatest extent possible, as quickly as possible.
You know, and one of the things that we haven't actually directly mentioned, but of course it relates to climate change, is water. And we now have California, the entire state, you know, being in a severe drought. And so in order to grow food, and it is the produce capital of the country, in order to grow food, you know, regions have to have water. And we're doing fairly well with that here in Colorado, but there are some places in the country, specifically strategic places like California, where water is such a huge issue.
Well, I think in truth it's an issue almost everywhere. I mean, not everywhere is facing drought, but large parts of our country are facing drought, and we're certainly facing drought in parts of Colorado. And as we look out into the future, we see that, you know, there is a looming water war, if you will, as municipalities grow, expecting that their populations will pretty dramatically increase in the next two or three decades, they're buying up farmland so that they can procure water rights. And, of course, in Colorado, we're rather famous for the oil and gas industry using, you know, hundreds of millions of gallons of water in the process of fracking. So it's going to be increasingly difficult for our farmers to get the water that they need to be able to produce food. So, yeah, this is one of the key challenges that we face in the future.
And, you know, yes, we're really, beset with fracking here in Colorado on the eastern side and the western side of the state, but we are only one place, you know, and around this country there are so many places where, you know, if there's one square inch that the frackers can frack, they will. And, of course, that just consumes unfathomable gallons of water. So this is a terrible, precarious situation all over the country.
Well, it is. And it's also important to realize that agriculture is the greatest user of water in our country. I think the number is something like 80 to 85% of our water is now going to agriculture. And, of course, much of that water is not being used wisely. So we're going to have to rethink how we grow our food in order to use water in a much more conservative, much more productive manner than we are right now.
Well, I want to ask you about that in a moment, but first I just really want to invite people to call in with your questions or comments for Michael. The number is 888-874-4888. Maybe you are a farmer, or maybe you are thinking about being a farmer, if you're maybe a young person considering that, going in that direction. Or maybe you're involved with local food and you have a comment or question for Michael, something you want to share, something you want to ask. 888-874-4888. We'd love to talk to you. I wanted to ask you, Michael, you've written that climate change will drastically reduce global food production capacity, and we will be compelled to adopt controlled environment agriculture, also known as greenhouses. And I find this is really fascinating, and I'm sure our listeners would love to hear more. So please take plenty of time to talk about that.
Sure. This is something that I think is very exciting and very important. To grow food in a world where our climate is out of control, as our farmers are already beginning to experience, we have to find a way to create controlled environments in which we can grow food. This means hoop houses, low tunnels, high tunnels, and greenhouses especially. Greenhouses with hydroponics, aquaponics, and aquaculture, all of these are needed. We need to greatly increase local food production capacity in this country. And we have concluded after studying this for a while that high-tech greenhouses represent one of the best ways to do this sustainably. So let me talk about some of the reasons why. We already know that small farm food production is quite a bit more efficient in raising food than conventional or commodity crop agriculture. But consider this. Standard commodity crop commercial agriculture yields, on average, somewhere in the range of $1,000 worth of revenues per acre per year, $1,000 worth of food, you could say, per acre per year. That's kind of a ballpark number, but it's a pretty good rule of thumb, whether you're talking about corn or wheat or soybeans. It's in that range, $1,000 an acre a year. With the kind of intensive organic agriculture that we see in many places in Colorado practiced by small farmers, small meaning from a few acres to maybe a few hundred acres, where they use biointensive methods, organic primarily, although they're not necessarily certified. But these kind of market farms, we often call them, are producing conservatively about $10,000 worth of produce per acre per year. So that's a whole order of magnitude above what's usual with commodity crop agriculture. But with these high-tech greenhouses that we're beginning to deploy now, using hydroponics, for instance, where the nutrients are brought to the plant through water, we can produce up to $1 million worth of produce per acre, per year. It's amazing. That's two orders of magnitude above our best biointensive organic food production, and three orders of magnitude greater than commodity crop production, utilizing a small fraction of the water and land that's usually needed to grow food. An example of this locally, the founder of an organization called Veterans to Farmers, based in Denver, founded by Buck Adams, who is a Marine vet and one of our advisors, he's involved in plans in Denver to build 40 acres of greenhouses on land owned by the city of Denver, out where the Stapleton Airport used to be. So 40 acres of greenhouses growing, you know, $1 million worth of produce per acre, this would certainly go a long way towards making it possible for Denver to meet its official sustainability goal of 20% food localization by 2020. And this was a very brave initiative of Mayor Michael Hancock, who grew up in a Denver food desert and understands very well the challenges ahead. But anyway, these kinds of developments in controlled environment agriculture are the kinds that are needed to take local food production to scale sustainably and resiliently.
And so, obviously, this could be adapted to different places. You know, this is, you're talking about Colorado, but it sounds like, you know, this could be adapted in many, many ways to other parts of the country and the world.
That's correct. And in industrialized nations, we're seeing many countries in the last couple of decades, particularly the Netherlands, Spain, and China, have adapted greenhouse production in those countries. I think China has something like, I read recently, they have about 2.5 million hectares in under glass in greenhouses. But the United States is last among those industrialized nations in greenhouse production. So it's something that has a lot of potential here and around the world. And I think over the next several years, many people will come to see that the increase of controlled environment agriculture may be the only way that we can significantly scale up local food production in order to meet our food needs.
You know, you've said so much tonight that is possible, and also you've talked about things that are really, really difficult and may not succeed. And I just want to point out that you and your perspective are really an example of the kind of thing that Guy and I talk about in our book and that we talk about individually in our work, which is, you know, that even in the face of near-term extinction or even because of near-term extinction, that we move forward and keep doing. You know, Guy is fond of quoting Edward Abbey, who says, if you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't, then do.
Yes.
So I am, you know, I look at you as really a profound example of that perspective. And I just want to salute you for what you're doing.
Well, thank you. It's a very steep learning curve that we're on. And those of us working on local food, we don't know to what degree we will be successful or if we'll fail miserably. But we know that it's essential that we do our best to do as much as possible, as quickly as possible, and to take notes about what we learn along the way.
Well, I'd like to know who some of your heroes are in this struggle. I'm sure you have some role models, so could you talk about that a bit?
Well, I have a long list of heroes.
And she-ros.
She-ros, too. Sure. So I'll just mention a few people that other people may be familiar with. of course, one of the greatest educators in helping us to understand our food and our food supply, of course, is Michael Pollan. You know, his book, Omnivore's Dilemma, has changed many people's lives, and In Defense of Food, more recently, is required reading, and his most recent book is about cooking, called Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. Wonderful, wonderful work. He has really fueled what all of us are doing around food. Joel Salatin and his family at Polyface Farm, they are educators and activists and exemplary farmers. They are an inspiration to many of us. Up in Vermont at Green Mountain College, Philip Ackerman Leist, who is an academic but is also a longtime farmer and food system activist. And he wrote the book Rebuilding the Food Shed, How to Create Local, Sustainable, and Secure Food Systems, which was published by Chelsea Green Publishing a couple of years ago. We've given away dozens of copies of this book to our food localization colleagues. And I'd have to say that Woody Cash, the founder of Slow Money, is one of my heroes as well, as he's helped us to realize that we've gone as unconscious about our money as we have about our food. And I think that the slow money approach to getting local capital into local food economies is an absolutely essential strategy in the process of localizing our food supply. And also Gary Nabhan, who recently wrote Growing Food in a Hotter, Drier Land. Really important work. And I'm just grateful that we have people like this on the planet right now who can help guide us through this very difficult passage. And most of the women that I'm familiar with who are leaders in this work are really local people in the area. People like Dana Miller, who founded Transition Denver and then went on to found Grow Local Colorado to give community gardening a huge boost. And then I'll mention lastly Robin O'Brien, another Boulder resident who is the author of The Unhealthy Truth, How Our Food is Making Us Sick and What We Can Do About It. It's also an extremely important book. So all these people are really evolutionary catalysts, keenly focused on bringing about a systemic approach to regaining our food sovereignty.
Well, I just want to let people know again that they can get in touch with you at localfoodshift.com. That's all one word, localfoodshift.com. And, you know, we didn't have too much time, but maybe we can just in a few seconds, in about 2.5 minutes, we could just mention that we had a huge flood here in the Boulder area last fall. It really damaged the livelihood of a lot of farmers here and is a classic example of how climate change can disrupt and even destroy our agriculture efforts. In about a minute or so, can you say something about that?
Well, yeah, the flood last September was devastating in lots of ways, but particularly to food production in the area, and it made us realize how vulnerable our local food producers really are and how the system, especially the federal system, is not designed to give them any support whatsoever. So we had to scramble to figure out how to get aid to many of our local producers. And so now we're in the process of realizing that as we're building our local food supply, our local food system or food shed, that we also have to learn how to make sure that it is resilient to the changes and disasters that can happen in the future. And that's something that we really weren't paying attention to before, but now we certainly are, because we will depend upon our local food producers.
I've been talking this last hour with Michael Brownlee, who works with and is co-founder of Local Food Shift in Boulder, Colorado, who is just a fabulous warrior crusader in this effort to localize our food, to help us disidentify as consumers, to take back our food production and our lives. And so I really want to thank Michael for being with us, and I want to remind everybody again that Guy McPherson is going to be here with us next week. We're going to be talking about our new book, Extinction Dialogues, How to Live with Death in Mind. Thank you all for listening. Please remember that you can find us on the archives as early as tomorrow morning at PRN-FM. Click on shows, scroll down to the Lifeboat Hour, and tell your friends about Guy McPherson being here next week. Thank you, Michael. Thank you, everyone. Good evening. Have a good week.
Thank you, Carolyn.
Old Black Joe's still picking cotton for your ribbons and bows.